Okay, here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So for today's sutta class, I'm trying to talk of some sutras outside of the Majjhima Nikaya, which we've done for such a long time. And so I picked out three sutras from the Samyutta Nikaya. It's that big blue book which is available in the library. It's one of the great sources of sutras. They're much shorter than the ones in the Majjhima Nikaya, which means that I usually do two or three in one group here. And these are some of my favorite sutras from one of the chapters in the Samyutta Nikaya called the Nidana Samyutta. Nidana means like cause, and especially it refers to what we know these days as dependent origination, the links. And I'm not going to go through the dependent origination per se, except just in brief at first of all, because it says in many of these that it mentions dependent origination, but just as ... in brief. And it's usually the links are from delusion, avijja. We get the karma formations of body, speech and mind. And from that we get the consciousness in our next lives. And when there is consciousness is also what I say is very easy, a very easy translation. We have the objects of consciousness, usually translated as name and form. And when we have consciousness and name and form, we also have the sense bases, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and knowing of the mind. And when we have those sense bases, we have the contact, when the sense base and the consciousness come together, in other words, it's something to be seen and you see it, that's called contact. Basically the turning on of the sensory apparatus. And from that we get this quality we call feeling, not emotional feelings. We're talking about the pleasure and pain or in between associated with every sensory experience. You like it, you dislike it, or it's in between. And from that Vedana, that becomes a cause of this thing called craving and wanting. We always want pleasurable sensations. We want to get rid of unpleasant ones. And from the craving, we get this wonderful word called upadana. Sometimes it's translated as attachment or grasping, but it has this other meaning which I prefer called taking up, fuel. And the craving becomes the fuel, the taking up of this interest in the world, if you like, which creates the existence. And from the existence, we have the birth. In the next life and from birth, we have old age, suffering and death. This is called the dependent origination, which is the whole subject of these group of Samyuttas. And it's also really important to know that as well as dependent origination, which is, the Buddha called the cause of all this suffering business, as well as that, we have what is called dependent cessation as well, which is much more interesting for those who want to become enlightened. It shows with the cessation of delusion, then all these karma formations which create rebirth in your future lives, they stop. And with, in other words, you're not making up a new life anymore. This is your last one. You've seen through it. So when the overcoming of delusion, then use the overcoming of the karma formations, they cease without remainder. When they cease without remainder, there's no consciousness in your next life, no objects of consciousness, obviously. There is no sense bases, no name and form. So no sense bases, no contact, no Vedana, no pleasure, pain, no craving, no more fuel, no more existence, no more birth, no more old age, suffering and death. Ending of it all. So that's the dependent cessation. Now that is just a central part of Buddhism. I only was mentioning that just in passing. It will be mentioned in here, but just as a dot, 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 because the main emphasis is on something else. So, the first sutta is answering the question, one of the best suttas, which answers the question, what is the difference between a sotapanna, you know, for the Sinhalese, the soul one, and the arahat, the fully enlightened one? And here we have this very, very beautiful simile, which I'll come across soon. So here we go from the 68th Sangyutta, 68th Sutta in the Nidana Sangyutta, titled Kosambi. On one occasion, the Venerable Musila, the Venerable Sawitta, the Venerable Narada, and the Venerable Ananda were living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Then the Venerable Sawitta said to the Venerable Musila, "Friend Musila, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from all tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge thus, with birth as a condition, aging and death comes to be? Friend Sawitta, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from all tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of you after pondering it, I know this, I see this, with birth as a condition, aging and death comes to be. And friend Musila, apart from faith, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it and everything else, does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge thus, with existence as a condition, there comes birth, and the rest of the factors of dependent origination, with upadana, fuel, as a condition, there is existence. With craving as a condition, there is this fuel. With feeling as a condition, there is this craving. With the six sense bases as a condition, there is this feeling. With the contact as a condition, there is the feeling. With the six sense bases, there is a contact. With the name and form, there is contact. With consciousness, there is name and form. With volitional formations, there is this consciousness in the next life. And with ignorance as a condition, I prefer delusion, volitional formations come to be. So all the factors taken one by one of dependent origination. And to each one, Musila replies, "Friend Sawitta, apart from faith, apart from acceptance of a view, after pondering it, I know this, I see this. With ignorance as a condition, there is volitional formations." And then, "Friend, apart from faith, apart from acceptance of a view, after pondering it, does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge? With the cessation of birth comes the cessation of aging and death." And this is the dependent cessation I was talking about. And each one of those, he asked Venerable Musila, "Are you just accepting this out of faith, out of personal preference, out of oral tradition, out of reason reflection, out of acceptance of a you after pondering it? Do you know this because of that?" And he said, "No, I know and see this. With the cessation of these things comes the cessation of old age and death." And then he asked a further question, "Friend Musila, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, does the Venerable Musila have personal knowledge thus, Nibbana is the cessation of existence? Friend Sawitta, apart from faith, apart from personal preference, apart from oral tradition, apart from reason reflection, apart from acceptance of a view after pondering it, I know this, I see this. Nibbana is the cessation of existence." Then the Venerable Musila is an arahat, one whose tents are destroyed. When this was said, Venerable Musila kept silent. Now, what they're actually meaning over here, if you don't see it straight away, is many people, they understand things just because they believe it out of faith, or they take it because it's a tradition. Your teacher said it, so it must be true because your teacher was supposed to be enlightened. Or you reflect upon it, you think about it with reason, it seems to make sense. You pondering it and then you accept it. These are all the ways of accepting a view without direct personal experience. And here, this monk was saying, no, I don't accept these things just because of faith or because of thinking about it. I know and see this. This is direct experience. And so they say, well, you must be an arahat. You have the direct experience of dependent origination and dependent cessation. And what did Musila say? He said he kept silent because there's a problem here. So any questions on that so far? Are you getting the point of what's happening here? Good. Then the Venerable Narada said to the Venerable Sarvita, Friend Sarvita, it would be good if I were to ask a series of questions. Ask that series of questions and I will answer you. Then let the Venerable Narada get to answer the series of questions. I will ask the Venerable Narada the series of questions and let him answer me. And here the Venerable Sarvita asked the Venerable Narada the same series of questions as were addressed to the Venerable Musila. And he answered them in exactly the same way. So, Sarvita said, the Venerable Narada is an arahat, one whose taints are destroyed. And then Narada replied, Friend, though I have clearly seen as it really is with correct wisdom, Nibbana is the cessation of existence and all the other things of the dependent origination. I am not an arahat. I am not one whose taints are destroyed. And now he gives a beautiful simile. Suppose, friend, there was a well along a desert road, but it had neither a rope nor a bucket. Then a man would come along, oppressed and afflicted by the heat, tired, parched and thirsty. And those of you who come to the sutras classes before, read the sutras yourself, you always notice where one word would have sufficed. In Pali, they have about four or five. In English, we'd just say he was thirsty. But here we say that he was oppressed and afflicted by the heat, tired, parched and thirsty. He would look down into the well, and the knowledge would occur to him, there is water. But he would not be able to make bodily contact with it. So too, friend, though I have clearly seen, as it really is with correct wisdom, that Nibbana is the cessation of existence, I am not an arahat, one whose taints are destroyed. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda asked the Venerable Sarvita, When he speaks in such a way, friend Sarvita, what would you say about the Venerable Narada? When he speaks in such a way, friend Ananda, I would not say anything about the Venerable Narada except what is good and favorable, which means that Venerable Sarvita agreed with what there was being said. So this is basically the difference between being a stream winner and being an arahat. A stream winner actually can see the water in the bottom of the well, but they haven't got the rope and bucket to get it yet, but they certainly know it is there. They've seen the Dhamma, but they haven't been able to drink it yet. That is the difference. So the stream winner does have the personal knowledge, direct knowledge, that this is the cause of suffering, of dependent origination, and they know that Nibbana is the cessation of existence, which I'll go into in a few seconds, that qualifies them as being a stream winner. By direct seeing that, knowing that, but they haven't got the water yet. They see it, but haven't drunk it. That's the difference between the stream winner and the arahat. Any comments? Okay. The taints. Now, this word is called the asavas. That's a Pali word. And sometimes it's very helpful to have some knowledge of that language. Because when we translate these things in English, there's all types of attempts to capture the meaning of that word. And sometimes you miss it. I've already mentioned this upadana, which is often called attachment or grasping. It has this other meaning, which is much more indicative of how it works within the dependent origination, the idea of a fuel. It literally does mean uptaking. For those of you who don't know much Pali, you know, you're probably able to work it out. It's upa and adana, as in the second precept. Adina, not given, adana, where ramanisi karpadang samadhyami. I will not take what's given. So this upa ardana. Ardana means taking something. And upa is, you know, pretty much the same, or has the same similar meaning as up in English. Remember that English is an Indo-Aryan language. And we have many words in Pali which you can trace have come up into English. An example of that. The word for a young man in Pali is yobana. Now you know where a yob comes from. It's a Pali word. So there's many of these little words you can trace back. And upa is actually just pretty much like up. So ardana, which you probably know from your precepts, taking up. It's not attachment. When you take up something, you get attached to it. I'm going to take up the clock. I'm grasping it. So it is pretty much the same, but it gives that other, a fuller picture of what the word really means. And that's what fuel is. You know, the engine of your car takes up the petrol, you know, into its engine and burns it. And that's the fuel. You know, you take up, you know, the rice and curry, and that's your fuel. Yeah, you take Angelie up on the matter. This is actually how it works. So it gives it a nicer, fuller meaning. So that's with the upadana, and the one which we're also talking about here, about what was it? About the taints. The word is asavas, and it literally means outflowings. It could also mean inflowings as well. But for those of you who have practiced, you know, meditation and gone reasonably deep, you know it's the tendency of the mind to go out, you know, into the world, out into the past, out into the future, out into thoughts and fantasies and doing things. And it's very hard, unless you're very skilled in meditation, actually to stay inside, to stay at home, if you like. And you can see, as a meditator, you can understand what that word really means. It's that force which always takes you out from where you are, going always somewhere else. The outflowings of the mind. And that, to me, is the meaning of these so-called taints. Taints doesn't have much of a meaning. It doesn't really add to the understanding of the Dhamma. But the outflowings, you can understand what that means. And understand how it works. And that when those outflowings are cut off and destroyed, you just stay at home. You don't need to go out and do anything. You're at peace. So that's the outflowings business. Is that okay? Okay, so that's the outflowings are destroyed. Now, just to make it even clearer, the difference between a stream winner and an arahat, this is one of those similes. Stream winner, you can see the Dhamma, you understand that, you know, this is what happens, this is why it all works, but you haven't done the practice to make this real. See the water in the bottom of the well, but you can't get at it yet. The next simile, which I've often given in the Sutta class or in the Dhamma class, is the old shipwrecked sailor simile. And that's in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, or Happiness Through Meditation, whichever version of that book you have. And that is when the shipwrecked sailor is floating in the ocean, and he can see dry land in the distance, but they haven't reached it yet. They can see it. Yeah, there's safety. Dry land is over there. That's the stream winner. And then once you see this dry land over there, of course you're going to start swimming to it. And they say when you're sort of some way on the way, it doesn't tell you how close you are to dry land. We call that the once returner. And the non-returner is you're so close to dry land, you can stand up, this solid land underneath your feet, but you're still in the waves. You are wading to the shore. That's the non-returner. And the last one is when, you know, you're on the shore, you're an arahat, you're safe. So that's why that's a beautiful simile, because it shows that the non-returner and the arahat are really, really close together. There's only a tiny bit difference between them. But for the stream winner, you've seen the Dhamma, you know exactly what to do. But as it says here, not through just belief or faith, not from personal reflection, not because it makes sense, not because you're following your teacher or the tradition, it's because you've seen it. That's the stream winner. So that is why these two monks, they say, yes, no, we know this. We know this dependent origination. We understand it totally. But we're not arahats yet. They've seen the water. They know how it all works, but they haven't totally overcome the avijja yet. So this whole process is still going on. But at least they've seen it. They've seen the shore, and it's only a matter of time before they swam far enough that they can actually stand in dry land. Yeah. But the nice thing about this is they say that once you have seen the Dhamma, it's you've gone past the point of no return. They say seven more lifetimes at most. And this is just if you can understand this, I like engaging my audience. If you know the answer to this, especially Nicholas, be quiet. So if you are a stream winner in this life, how many more births have you got? How many? Oh, people are too smart these days. You're right, six more births. Because this life counts as one. And your next life is number two. So sometimes people think, oh, I've only got seven more rebirths. Is that only six, actually? Because it's the Asian way of doing things. You know that as soon as you're born, you're 1 year old. And then your first birthday, you're two. So that's, you know, the Asian way of counting. It's the same way when they say seven lifetimes. This one is number one. The next one is number two. So if you're a stream winner, you've got six more lives at most. And the other thing is you have to. You've got no choice. It's going to happen. So that's why I tell people, you don't hang around here too much. It's the point of no return. You can't keep going on. It's not up to you anymore. So that's part of it. The other thing I really like about this sutta is very clear, but it can be very controversial. Nibbana, the cessation of existence. Now that is a very powerful statement, which scares a lot of people. Because sometimes people work so hard to become enlightened that they want to enjoy it afterwards, to live happily ever after. But here the Buddha says, no, Nibbana is the cessation of living happily or unhappily anywhere. It's the end of ever after, not the beginning of ever after. The end of ever after. Because for many people in the spiritual path, they want what I call the ultimate retirement home, where they can retire from all of the hard work of practicing and precepts and looking after stuff, retire and live happily ever after. The Cinderella and Prince Charming sort of idea of heaven. And the Buddha is this, wow, no way, very clear. This is the cessation of everything. The cessation of existence. Bhava Nirodha. That really upsets a lot of people. But at least, those of you here know what you're getting into. This is not carrying on forever and ever after. This is stopping existence. Da, da, da. That's why there's very few streamers. Because they don't want to stop existence, they want to just try and tidy it up, get rid of the suffering part, just have happiness. You know, the idea of a heaven realm. That's so common in so many people's ideas. You know, you die, you go to heaven, live happily ever after. You know, with your wife, who you love very much, and now, you know, she's died, and you can be reunited with your wife. But does your wife want to be reunited with you? That's going to be a big trouble in heaven, people think like that. That's one of the reasons why the Christian church, you can at least understand they're logical about this. That's why they didn't allow people to marry twice. I mean, cause who are you going to live with when you get to heaven? Your first wife, your second wife? You know, they're going to argue like hell. It's not going to be heaven for them if you've got, you know, two women fighting over the same guy. It's not going to be heaven for the guy either. So you can see all these amazing sort of possibilities. You know, people want their dog to go with them, you know, over to heaven. And maybe what about the cats have gone to heaven as well? It's going to be a pretty noisy place. Anyway, we won't go into that. So this... two things in this sutra. It gives you the understanding of the difference between streamlining and an arahat, and it also gives you the cessation of existence, is nibbana, very clearly said here, and very well translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Any questions? Okay, very good. It's going to be a short one, which is great. The next one, Kachana Gota, again, this is, again, one of my favorites. Not just my favorites, but it's one of the most famous small sutras in the whole of the Pali Canon. For those of you who are students of the history of Buddhism, as Buddhism developed, you know, we started getting the arising of the Mahayana, and especially the idea of emptiness, of sunyata, of nothing there. Is there something or is there nothing? Is it all one? Or is there nothing at all? And again, it was actually a few months ago, as a Christian came and he was trying to sort of be cheeky to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you have to admit that nothing is better than God. And I said, yeah, actually, I agree with you. Nothing, emptiness, is much better than God. He said, that's not what I meant. But nothing, emptiness, that's the highest. But what does it really mean by nothing? Is it really true that emptiness is empty? And that's where the philosophy of Mahayana was going. Until this character, who's very well known by scholars, Nagarjuna, came along and introduced what became known as Majjhimaka philosophy in Buddhism. And that is based totally on this small sutta. This guy, Nagarjuna, he looked at this sutta and he said, no, you can't say there's absolutely nothing at all. That's taking this idea of emptiness, nothingness too far. Nor can you say like there is something, a soul, that things are solid. He said, there is a third way. And he based all of that teaching on this little sutta. And this became really, really famous in Buddhism. And that's why many scholars will sometimes say, you know, is this Majjhima Nikaya, is it Mahayana or Theravada? And I agree with many scholars that this guy Nagarjuna was actually bringing Mahayana back into line with Theravada, based on this sutta. So let's see the sutta now. It's short, but really, really powerful. This was at Sarvati, where the Buddha spent a lot of time. Then the Venerable Kacchana Gota approached the Blessed One, the Buddha, paid homage to him, sat down on one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, in what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view?" No, samaditi. Now, there's many different explanations of right view. This is one of them, and one of the most powerful. "This world, Kacchana, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence." I would actually translate the existence with another word which gives it a much easier understandable idea, persistence. But the idea of existence is that it's there not just for a moment, but it actually is there for a reasonable long period of time. Okay, so existence, things actually are for long enough for you to know them, touch them, or see them. So a little bit of persistence in time. And the notion of non-existence. "But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is." It doesn't mean like the origin of the universe or the origin of planet Earth. It means the world of ideas, things, mind, anything. That's why I prefer here the origin of things as it really is with correct wisdom. "There is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world, or persistence." So they say you can't say there's nothing because an arising can be seen. When people say there is nothing at all, I think that was a philosophy of an English philosopher, and George Bernard Shaw kicked him and said, I prove you wrong thus. When he said there's nothing at all, and said, "Well, you know, you just felt my boot, didn't you?" So you can't say there's nothing, because an arising of phenomena, you know, what you think is existence, that is there. But you can't say, when you see there's a cessation, a falling away of things, you can't say it persists. You can't say it is. And you can't say it is not. It is in between that, this third option. Get this one? You can't say there are things, because they disappear very quickly. Nor can you say there's nothing at all, because an arising of things can be perceived. So let's carry on a bit. "This world, Kacchana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging and adherence, fuel. But this one with right view does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency. You do not make a stand about myself, me, I. You have no perplexity or doubt that what arises is not a me, not an I, not an Ajahn Brahm. What arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceasing. His knowledge about this is independent of others. In this way, Kacchana, there is this right view. All exists. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is a second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, the Buddha, teaches the Dhamma by the middle, another middle way. With delusion as a condition, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as condition, consciousness comes to be. The whole of this dependent origination. And such is the origination of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainless fading away and cessation of delusion, comes the cessation of volitional formations, the cessation of volitional formations, the cessation of consciousness, cessation of consciousness, the cessation of name and form, cessation of name and form, the cessation of the sense bases, the cessation of the sense bases, the cessation of contact. The cessation of contact comes a cessation of feeling. Cessation of healing comes a cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of this fuel. From the cessation of fuel comes the cessation of existence. From the cessation of existence comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of old age, sickness and death. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So instead of saying a person is or is not, we have the middle way said by the Buddha, which for want of a better word in English we call the process. So you are a process, not nothing, nor a thing, but just a process. Cause and effect carrying on through the period of your existence. So when you say, are you? Say no. Are you not? No. You're in the middle. You're arising and passing away. Every moment. Any questions? Have I dumbfounded you? Can you understand what I'm saying? It's a middle way, dependent arising. And also, it does have this other wonderful saying that all there is suffering arising, suffering passing away. Not me, just an irritation of having to listen to another Dhamma talk. The irritation of having to get old. The irritation of having to brush your teeth and go to the toilet. And that is one of the reasons why that another sutta, it's not here, it's somewhere else, that it was, I think, Bhikkhuni Sanyutta, one of my favorite bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha, totally enlightened. And the Mara came along to her and says, basically, who do you think you are? You know, a woman trying to become enlightened. And that's, she's really sort of pushed her. And she just said, look, what are you talking about me? There's no me here. She said, all there is suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all there is. Not a person, not a bhikkhuni. Just suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all this is. And that was the words of an enlightened nun. So that's actually how an enlightened being would describe themselves. They say, who are you? Say, no one here, just suffering arising, suffering passing away. Interesting. And you might think they say that being a misery, but no, they say that with this huge smile on their face. Just suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all. And that becomes a very powerful description of the enlightened being. And that's also sometimes I try and test people out to see if they really understand what we're talking about. And I ask them the question, an enlightened being, an arahat, do they experience suffering? What is the answer? You're enlightened, fully enlightened, an arahat, do you experience suffering? Oh, you're too scared of me, because I do trick questions sometimes, but this is actually quite a straightforward question. And the answer is yes, they suffer. That's all there is. It's suffering, suffer pain, suffer irritation. It's all suffering. Suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all there is. Of course they would. So, that is one of the reasons why in the Theragata, so many of these enlightened monks and nuns, they describe their state of having become enlightened but not yet passed away as a workman waiting for their wages. They've done the job, but the check's in the mail. They haven't been paid yet. They get paid in Parinibbana when everything stops. They haven't been paid yet, so the enlightened being is still irritated. They still have to go to the toilet. That's fascinating. So this is what an enlightened, but all they say is suffering coming, suffering passing away. No one's suffering. They're not suffering. It's just suffering arising, suffering passing away. That's all. That's the difference between an ordinary person and an enlightened being. Just suffering arising, suffering or passing away. But they're not suffering. There's no one there to suffer. It's just a process. Not something.
Would you agree that
Oh, yeah. You come up with that before your parents get to you. You've also always got an identity before. So that's why some go, "You're a girl." You say, "No, I'm not, I'm a boy." "See, you're a girl, but I was a boy last time." So you come up with all sorts of stuff. But yeah, you're certainly your parents and your culture, they reinforce the individuality. But it was there to begin with, before you were born. Okay, so now let's carry on with this theme. The uninstructed. And again, this is also one of my favourites. Because those of you who know that one of the little heresies which I condemn and I get into trouble for doing it is to have the idea that an enlightened being, they just enter the original mind and they stay there forever and they just have happiness ever after just with an original, permanent, primordial, ground of all being, consciousness. And this is a sutta which totally blows apart such a heresy. The uninstructed. "Thus I have heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park. Bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling, might experience revulsion towards his body composed of the four great elements. He might become dispassionate towards it and be liberated from it. For what reason? Because growth and decline is seen in this body composed of the four great elements. Is seen being taken up and laid aside." In other words, you know, you can see birth and you know it's going to end up in death. You know you're getting older every day. Some of you, it's not going to get better. You're going to get sort of more frail and more sicknesses coming up. So you can understand why people get dispassionate and fed up with this body. And especially in the context of rebirth, you have to go through this all over again. You understand, what am I doing this for? "Therefore, the uninstructed worldling might experience a revulsion towards his body composed of the four great elements. He might become dispassionate towards it and be liberated from it. But, bhikkhus," that's monks, "as to what is called mind, mentality or consciousness." Now, one thing which doesn't come out here, which is very clear in the Pali. Pali was like Latin. It's very precise. It is one thing which is sometimes called mind, sometimes called mentality, sometimes called consciousness. It's not three things. It's one thing which has, three different names. Because Buddhism would always use this ordinary language. It would never try to be precise in the sense of always trying to fix the meaning of things by being being as precise as in a dictionary or whatever. It would just use words as people would use it. And that I sometimes say consciousness, heart, mind, and it's the same thing you're talking about. And it's exactly the same in Pali. There's many other places too where the Buddha says consciousness, you sometimes call it that, or mind, sometimes you call it that. What's the other thing he calls it? Mentality. This is like an or, if you like. That one thing, which is called mind or mentality or consciousness. The uninstructed worldling is unable to experience revulsion towards it. Yeah, you can get revulsion towards your body, fed up with this body getting old, but the mind, you're not put off by it. Is unable to become dispassionate towards this mentality and be liberated from it. For what reason? Because for a long time this has been held by him, appropriated and grasped thus. This is mine. Your consciousness, mentality, thoughts, emotions. This I am. This is myself. Therefore, the uninstructed worldling is unable to experience revulsion towards it, unable to become dispassionate towards it, and be liberated from it. It's a very powerful teaching. It's okay to say let go of the body, but we want to keep our mind and go to a heaven realm. But, says the Buddha, it would be better monks, for the uninstructed worldling to take as itself, who you think you are, this body, composed of the four great elements, rather than this mind as yourself. For what reason? Because this body composed of the four great elements is seen standing for 1 year, 2 years, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, for 100 years or even longer. The body lasts a long time. But this thing which we call the mind, or mentality, or consciousness, arises as one thing and ceases as another by day and by night. It's always changing rapidly. This thing called your mind arises as one thing, passes away as another thing. Just in one day or one night, so many thousands, millions of times. Just as a monkey roaming through a forest grabs hold of one branch, lets that go, and grabs another, and then lets that go, and grabs to another, so to that which is called mind and mentality and consciousness arises as one thing and ceases as another by day and by night. And that's also, by the way, where we all get that monkey mind simile, you know, from this sutta. But it's also the idea of the mind constantly changing, of the body having some sense of persistence for such a long time. Therein, monks, the instructed noble disciple attends closely and carefully to dependent origination itself thus. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. In other words, that all there is because of some cause. When the cause arises, the thing arises. When the cause finishes, that finishes. Mentality included. Your mind, consciousness will, just a causal process. When something arises, say you can smell the delicious food, you get hungry. You just find the cause of it. When somebody pushes your button, that's the causes, you get upset and angry. Cause and effect. That's all there is. And that is, with delusion as a condition, volitional formations come to be, volitional formations, consciousness, and so on. Such is their origin, this whole mass of suffering. But the remainder's fading away and cessation of delusion comes the cessation of volitional formations, the cessation of volitional formations, which is the karma, cessation of consciousness in your next life, so on. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So even see this mental world as a process, arising as one thing, ceasing as another by day or by night, so fast, they say it's much better, more logical to see this body as yourself, at least it lasts. But this mind, consciousness, or will, whatever you take yourself to be, that changes so fast. Why do you say, that is me, that is mine? That is the self. So seeing this, monks, the instructed noble disciple experiences revulsion towards form, to body, revulsion towards the mental world as well, to feeling, to pleasure and pain. Not just revulsion to the pain, revulsion even to the pleasure as well. Because you can't have one without the other. Revulsion towards perception, experiencing stuff, revulsion towards volitional formations, towards will. That's a tough one, but that's central. To be fed up with this will, instead of using this will and relying on it as a path to freedom and happiness, you're fed up with this will. Chuck it out. And revulsion towards consciousness. Not always wanting to be. Revulsion towards all the consciousnesses, including mind consciousness. Experiencing revulsion, you become dispassionate towards it, fed up with it. Through dispassion, your mind becomes liberated, no longer attached to it. When it's liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. Great thing here, you can't be enlightened and not know it. The knowledge comes, yeah, you're free. You understand. Destroyed is all birth. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done had been done. You're a workman, done the job, waiting for your wages. There is no more for this or any other state of being. Finished. Very brilliant suttas here. So this particular sutta is just especially pointing out just how many people, yes, even as Buddhists, you know, you get fed up. You understand what rebirth is. And keep coming back again, reincarnation, and just get fed up with getting reborn again. But how are you fed up with the mind as well? Rising as one thing, ceasing as another. Few people are. That's why they keep getting reborn. I know one movie I saw on an aircraft some years ago, because Ron Battersby told me I should see it, was Groundhog Day. Remember Groundhog Day? The guy always getting reborn the same morning, going through it again and again. And after doing that 1,000 times, I didn't say how many, because I really got fed up. The same old stuff, again and again then. It was like getting revulsion towards rebirth. But he never got the revulsion towards the mind. Because that's why in the end he fell in love, and that broke the spell. That was just a sick ending. If he just see the monk or something, started meditating and then just never woke up at all the following morning, instead of waking up and just falling in love, then that would have been a really good movie, but I don't think anyone would have understood that. But nevertheless, that was Groundhog Day. Almost there, but not quite. So, can you feel revulsion towards your mental world? How can you do that? Okay. How you do that is you just start meditating and get sort of still. So the mental world starts to settle down and much of it disappears. All your thoughts go. It's so much nicer not to have thinking. Feel so much freer. So when you experience that, just, well, I've been thinking all the time. So much easier when you don't have to worry about the past and the future. You're just like a young kid again, just not worrying. You feel so, and you get revulsion towards it, just worrying and planning and having to remember things. And then you're just feeling this body, the feelings of the 5 senses. We know what it's like when the 5 senses vanish. Oh, gee, this is so much freedom when you haven't got a body and sight and feelings in the body to worry about. Ah, this is bliss. So compared to those states, you know, this body is an irritation. And then when you get into the second jhanas and above, the will vanishes. Oh, such a freedom. Not to have this thing inside of you, which you think is yours. It's not yours at all. Always telling you what to do, giving you orders, making you do things. That's called the will. It stops you resting. Then you're resting and think, I've got to do something. That's the will, you know, irritating you again. But when you get so still that there's no will left, ah, that's so quiet and peaceful. When you come out afterwards, you get very irritated at this will business. You get revulsion towards it. And this consciousness, when that starts to vanish, peace at last. Not having to know things. Peace. You know how hard it is learning Buddhism? Learning anything? Haven't you got revulsion towards learning? How much more? How old are you now, Aisling? You still have to go to school and classes? Jeez, do I have to do this forever? You get revulsion after a while. So just let it go. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Indeed, my own father, who was actually, when I asked him about God, he said, no, I went through the Second World War, I saw so much suffering, I can't believe in a God. You know, any God who had power and compassion would never allow such things to happen. So a lot of people turned away from that. But it's more than that, it's actually seeing the nature of this process, dependent origination. This process actually shows just how rebirth happens. You may sort of get fed up with sort of a God, fed up with this body, fed up with politicians. but you still have these volitional formations, you still have this craving. And when you still have that, you're going to get reborn again. Somewhere. So you're going to have to go through it all over again. As you know, there's many sort of videos on YouTube of people who fought in the Second World War, reborn again. There's that famous one which many people have seen of this young kid in the United States who was an aviator, remembered where he was shot down and went back there to put some flowers. He was only about 10 years of age or something. Went back to where his plane was shot down, remembered everything and all his mates in the same squadron. You know, full recall of the names and everything. And the video, the TV channel, whatever it was, they took him back to the place where he was shot down. And this little 10-year-old kid put some flowers on the ocean. Very beautiful. To just get some closure from his past life. There are lots of little stories like that of people who died in the Second World War who got reborn again. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the craving not to be. That, again, is trying to use your will to stop existence. You really have to stop the will, not use the will to stop being reborn. And then, you know, once you understand what this will is, you can see just how that just... The Buddha said it's like a dog trying to chase its tail, just you can't get to it. Because if you try not to get reborn, that trying is what creates the reborn. And that is one of the reasons why you see me teaching meditation year after year after year after year. Stop trying, for goodness sake. Stop trying to get enlightened. You're just chasing your tail. And you know that's what it feels like in meditation. I'm going to watch the breath, and you just can't get it. And try, and it gets harder and harder and harder. Try to be peaceful, and you just get more disturbed. And you just say, that's not the way. Let go of the will. Stop trying. Just let go of the past and the future and just be. And then everything comes together. Yeah, just go with the flow. Okay, yes. Yeah, that's right, yeah. You get revulsion towards the whole five khandhas. Yeah. This is usually the... repeated so many times. That first of all, you see things as they truly are. And it's always based on the jhanas. When you see things as they truly are, that's the stream winner. And as soon as you see things as they truly are, you get revulsion. This lovely word, nibbida. And I was trying to sort of get a nice little metaphor for it. I call it, you know, the wheel of existence, you know, like a wheel. It's the ejection seat. You know, like in the James Bond movie, press the ejector button, and the person sitting in the passenger seat got thrown out of the car. That's the ejector seat of samsara, nibbida. You know, it just throws you out of the wheel of existence. So it is a negativity. So what am I doing this for? I was just talking to Venerable Dharmapala earlier on this weekend. We're talking about all sorts of stuff when we hang out together, about sort of the last time I took alcohol. And this was, you know, I've told this story so many times, in Cambridge University, the scholars' dinner. And it just had so much alcohol. And this was, even one of the guys was a Nobel laureate, chemistry. And, you know, all the lecturers and professors and the scholar students all got totally drunk. And I woke up in the morning. I don't know how I got back to my room, my bed. You know, it's amazing, this, you know, the homing instinct when you're drunk. And I woke up with a pile of vomit on my pillow. I never realized you could die like that. But I was so disgusted. And, you know, this total revulsion came to alcohol. And that was the last time I ever drank any alcohol in my life. You know, you just went to an extreme and you get so revolted by it. And that sort of pushed me off that addiction or interest in alcohol. And that's the sort of thing which, you know, is nibbida, revulsion. This is, what am I doing this for? This is crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh no, they're there next year. Yeah, it is. A lot of time it's because people just, they want to fit in. and they believe what other people are saying. They always said, oh, yeah, really good fun last night. Oh, yeah, we really got sort of, I was going to use that word I should have used on Friday night. We really got very drunk. But, you know, they thought it was a good time. But, you know, one of the things with being sort of scientists, I suppose, you're always questioning. And maybe it's 60s or whatever, you always encourage, question, challenge, rebel. So then, a good time, was this really a good time? As soon as you ask the question, it wasn't a good time at all. You had much more fun when you didn't take alcohol. So I mean, that was going to an extreme. But I use that example as what this libido is. And sometimes you wake up in the morning, you've been smoking, and you look at just your breath smells, and it's disgusting. And that disgust means, I'm not going to do this anymore. And that sort of stops you. And from that sort of disgust, revulsion, you become dispassionate. You're not interested in it anymore. And then you become liberated from that. You get liberated from alcohol, liberated from smoking, liberated from these other defilements. What am I doing that for? Ridiculous. Yes. Oh, so over there, yeah? Can you ask for a question, yeah? Yes, it does. That's what happens. When you get revolted by, you know, some of the bad behavior, which, you know, we all do, you see it in yourself, and say, I don't want to be like this. So from that revulsion, it doesn't happen immediately. When you get revolted by that, you see, this is not what I want to do in life. Sometimes it takes a time to kick the smoking habit or kick the alcohol habit. But you know, you're on the path now. You just don't want to be like that anymore. And the same with getting angry. Once you realize this, it's not a very good way of getting your own way or solving any problems in life. There's so many much better ways. So you give up being angry. Little by little, it's a habit which falls away. So the revulsion, disgust towards it, is really important. I think that's one of the reasons why the smoking campaigns you see on the big billboards about, you know, lungs or something which would be ruined by smoke. Really graphic, you know, gross pictures sometimes you see it on the billboards. Yeah. Yeah, it could be that, but it just really means that, you know, you're not interested in the body anymore. You look after it, but you don't sort of cherish it anymore. Because you realize it's not me, not mine. But it's still getting into the mind things, and not just the jhanas, other mental states. Okay, very good. For once, I'm going to finish on time. Usually go to about 5 o'clock or something. So hopefully you enjoyed this today. If you like this, please take it back, because the three suttas, they do tie in together. She's got pretty. She's giving me an advert there. So you can take this back with you, but if you do want to leave it here, that please leave it here, and then don't just throw it in the dustbin, because these are suttas. You can, what's it called, shred it. Because, you know, you don't like putting stuff in dustbins, so be shredded. Okay, so thank you very much for listening. Now we can pay respect to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can go our own ways. Sadhu, sadhu. Abhivadeimi Savakato.